For the Japanese, he wrote, the Greater East Asia War is a purifying exorcism, a cleansing ablution. Other influential intellectuals, professors of history and philosophy at Kyoto Imperial University, added that war is eternal and should be recognized as being creative and constructive. Japanese religious nationalism outdid its European counterpart in one respect: the glorification of the war dead. Europeans honored their fallen soldiers with monuments and holidays. The Japanese worshipped them, and still worship them, as gods. Almost 2.5 million are so honored at the Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo. Not only kamikaze pilots, but less distinguished soldiers and even army nurses. At the shrine, which is filled with photos and other memorabilia of the deceased, worshippers leave small plaques inscribed with their prayers. It was in the knowledge that they would become kami and be appealed to by ordinary citizens for intervention in such mundane matters as high school grades that 6,000 young Japanese volunteered for suicide missions in World War II. A poem found on the body of one Japanese soldier after the Battle of Attu in the Aleutians was translated as saying, I will become a deity with a smile in the heavy fog. I am only waiting for the day of death. American patriotism. In the American vernacular, there is no such thing as American nationalism. Nationalism is a suspect category, an ism like communism, and confined to other people: Serbs, Russians, Palestinians, Tamils. Americans who love their country and profess a willingness to die for it are not nationalists, but something nobler and more native to their land. They are patriots. In some ways, this is a justifiable distinction. If all nations are imagined communities, America is more imaginary than most. It has no Volk, only a conglomeration of ethnically and racially diverse peoples, and it has no feudal warrior tradition to serve as a model for an imaginary lineage the average citizen might imagine himself or herself a part of. But at the same time, there can be no better measure of America's overweening nationalist pride than the fact that we need a special American name for it. Nationalism, in contemporary usage, is un-American and prone to irrational and bloody excess, while patriotism, which is quintessentially American, is clear-headed and virtuous. By convincing ourselves that our nationalism is unique among nationalisms, we do not have to acknowledge its primitive and bloody side. Americans might well take pride in their uniquely secular civic tradition. The Founding Fathers were careful to separate church and state, not only because they feared the divisiveness of religious sectarianism, but because they did not want to sacralize the state. Their aim was to ensure, as John Adams wrote, that government shall be considered as having in it nothing more mysterious or divine than other arts or sciences. But war inevitably wore down the wall between church and state, between government and the divine. In the late 19th century, America's imperialist ventures abroad helped infuse American patriotism with a new quasi-religious fervor. Then, during the Cold War, that immediately followed World War II, American nationalism began to invoke the dominant Protestant religion, to the point often of seeming to merge with it. Patriotic Americans countered the official atheism of the enemy nation with a proud fusion of flag and faith. The point was not so much religious belief as belief in the value of religion. Historian Stephen J. Whitfield has argued, and above all, the conviction that religion was virtually synonymous with American nationalism. But for all its debts to the Protestant tradition, American nationalism does not depend on any particular religion for its religious dimension. It is, practically speaking, a religion unto itself. Our civil religion, to use American sociologist Robert Bella's phrase. In some of its more fervent and sectarian versions, American nationalism makes common cause with white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and Christian millenarianism, and even adopts Nazi symbolism. But my concern here is with the more mainstream form of nationalism, which is thought to unite all of America's different races, classes, and ethnic groups. Compared to the blood-soaked rhetoric and rituals of Nazism, this civil religion is a bland and innocuous business, perhaps especially to someone who was raised within its liturgy of songs, processions, prayers, and salutes. It is, nonetheless, an extension and a celebration of American militarism, and no less bellicose in its implications than state Shinto or Nazism. American patriotism, like the nationalisms of other nations, is celebrated on special holidays, and these are, in most instances, dedicated to particular wars or the memory of war. The 4th of July, Memorial Day, Flag Day, and Veterans Day all provide occasions for militaristic parades and the display of nationalistic emblems and symbols, especially the flag. On these and other occasions, such as commemorations of particular wars or battles, bugles are blown, wreaths are ceremoniously laid on monuments or graves, veterans dress up in their old uniforms, and politicians deliver speeches glorifying the nationalistic values of duty and sacrifice. Through such rituals and observances of nationalism as a secular religion, historian George L. Moss has written, "War is made sacred." But the religion of American patriotism is also distinctive in at least two ways. First, it features a peculiar kind of idolatry, which can only be called a cult of the flag. Other comparable English-speaking nations, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia, do not indulge in flag worship. According to the Wall Street Journal, November 7, 1996, British efforts to create a mass market for Union Jacks have fallen flat. Many don't like what it stands for. A fair number aren't sure when, or if, the law lets them unfurl it. Quite a few haven't the foggiest idea of which side of it is up. Just as the wartime Japanese fetishized the emperor's portrait, Americans fetishize their flag. A patriotic pamphlet from 1900 declared in unabashedly religious terms that the United States must develop, define, and protect the cult of her flag, and the symbol of that cult, the Star-Spangled Banner, must be kept inviolate, as are the emblems of all religions. Early 20th century leaders of the Daughters of the American Revolution held that what the cross is to our church, the flag is to our country. And, in more overtly primitive terms, that the flag had been made sacred and holy by bloody sacrifice. The American flag can be found in almost every kind of public space, including churches, and it must be handled in carefully prescribed ritual ways, down to the procedure for folding. It is worshipped by displaying it, by pledging allegiance to it, and, occasionally, by kneeling and kissing it. It is the subject of our national anthem, which celebrates a military victory signaled by the survival, not of the American soldiers, but of the American flag, when the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. And anyone who still doubts that the American flag is an object of religious veneration need only consider the language of the proposed constitutional amendment, narrowly defeated in the Senate in 1995, forbidding the desecration of flags. The other distinctive feature of American nationalism as religion, at least as compared to those of more secular-minded nations, is its frequent invocation of God. We pledge allegiance to a nation under God. Our coins bear the inscription, "In God We Trust." This was not just a concession to America's predominant Christianity, as Bella explains, because the God being invoked is not exactly the Christian God. The God of the civil religion is, on the austere side, much more related to order, law, and right than to salvation and love. He is actively interested and involved in history, with a special concern for America. Here the analogy has much less to do with natural law than with ancient Israel. The equation of America with Israel is not infrequent. Put more bluntly, this is the Old Testament God, short-tempered and tribalistic, and it is not so much order, law, and right that concern him, as it is the fate of his people, Americans, that is, as his chosen people, in war. Though I am borrowing some of his insights, I should make it clear that Bella's concept of the American civil religion is quite different and does not explicitly involve nationalism or militarism. He imagines it as some vague, generic type of religion that actually exists alongside of, and rather clearly differentiated from, the churches, and serves to provide a transcendent framework for our notion of America. Only when he observes that the civil religion has not always been invoked in favor of worthy causes, and that it lends itself readily to the intolerant nationalism of the American Legion type of ideology, do the euphemisms begin to crack, revealing that what we are talking about sounds very much like nationalism. If God is on our side, Moral Majority Leader Jerry Falwell observed confidently in 1980, no matter how militarily superior the Soviet Union is, they could never touch us. God would miraculously protect America. In fact, every aspect of America's civil religion has been shaped by, or forged in, the experience of war. Memorial Day and Veterans Day honor the soldiers, both living and dead, who fought in past wars, and war veterans are prominent in the celebration of Independence Day and in promoting the year-round cult of the flag. The cult itself can be dated from the Spanish-American War, which signaled America's emergence as a global imperialist power. It was on the day after the United States declared war on Spain that the first statute requiring schoolchildren to salute the flag was passed by the New York State Legislature. And in the wake of World War I, 18 states passed similar statutes. And it was in the 1950s, at the height of the Cold War, that the coins and the Pledge of Allegiance were modified to include the word God. At the middle of a century that included American involvement in two world wars and military incursions into the Caribbean, Central America, Korea, and the Philippines, America was a nation draped in flags, addicted to military ritual, and convinced that it was carrying out the will of a stern and highly partisan deity. America's civil religion is limited, however, in ways that Nazism and state Shinto were not. Democracy guarantees, or at least has guaranteed so far, that Americans will not have some central godlike figure, a Führer, or an emperor, to focus and excite their nationalist zeal. Then there is the multi-ethnic and multiracial character of the American population. America is no nation, the British ambassador observed dismissively at the outbreak of World War I. Just a collection of people who neutralize each other. Lacking a Führer or a Volk, America's civil religion has the potential to focus on the American and Enlightenment ideals of democracy and freedom. This would be something truly unique among nationalisms, a loyalty to country, tempered and strengthened by a vision of a just polity that extends to all of humankind. Such inclusive visions, international socialism being another, have not, of course, fared well in the era of nationalism. Within the United States, a national loyalty based on Enlightenment ideals has had to compete again and again with the more fervent and Volkish forms of nationalism, nourished by nativism and racism. The Christian right, for example, is as much a nationalist movement as a religious one, and serves as an ardent lobby for the U.S. military. The bearing of the sword by the government is correct and proper. Falwell wrote, during the Cold War, segueing easily from bladed to nuclear weapons. Nowhere in the Bible is there a rebuke for the bearing of armaments. But the Old Testament-style thunderings of the Christian rite are only a particularly florid version of the civil religion shared by the great majority of Americans. Since the end of the Cold War, America's quasi-religious nationalism has continued to thrive without a godless enemy, without a consistent enemy at all, nourished by war itself. In other times and settings, outbursts of nationalist fervor have often served as a preparation for war. But in the United States, the causality increasingly works the other way, with war and warlike interventions serving, and sometimes apparently being employed, to whip up nationalist enthusiasm. Nations make war, and that often seems to be their most clear-cut function. But we should also recall Hegel's idea that, by arousing the passions of solidarity and transcendence, war makes nations, or at least revives and refreshes them. The United States is hardly alone in its use of war to further domestic political aims. In 1982, Margaret Thatcher's brief war with Argentina over the Falkland Islands occasioned an outburst of British nationalism and an enormous boost for Thatcher in the polls. Serbian aggression in the former Yugoslavia temporarily salvaged the Milosevic government from the disastrous consequences of its economic policies. Or take the curious case of Ecuador, which is not normally thought of as a nationalistic society at all. After ordering his troops to resist Peruvian border incursions in early 1995, the deeply unpopular 73-year-old Ecuadorian president, Sixto Duran Bayan, found himself suddenly bathed in the nationalist fountain of youth, as the New York Times put it. Flag-waving crowds welcomed him back from a diplomatic tour, and he could be seen daily on the balcony of the presidential palace, energetically pumping the air with his right fist, and leading crowds in rhythmic chants of, "Not one step back." No doubt, when the armed confrontation subsided, Ecuadorians went back to burning Sixto dolls in effigy. In the post-Cold War United States, though, wars, or at least interventions, became the habitual cure for domestic malaise. Ronald Reagan used a Marxist coup in Grenada as the excuse to raid that island in 1983. George H.W. Bush discovered the energizing effects of military action early in his presidency, with his thrillingly swift invasion of Panama and capture of its de facto head of state. 2.5 years later, with the economy in recession and his approval ratings down, Bush decided to respond to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait with a massive U.S.-led military intervention, Operation Desert Storm. Public opinion was evenly divided on the necessity of war right up until the eve of hostilities. But once the killing began, it was popular enough to boost Bush's approval ratings to over 90%. The Gulf War evoked a burst of nationalist religiosity that, although clearly manipulated by television coverage of the war, seemed to be both spontaneous and deeply felt. Flags appeared everywhere, along with bumper stickers, T-shirts, and buttons, urging Americans to support our troops. As if flags were not a sufficient proof of loyalty, they were joined by yellow ribbons, which had been originally displayed in solidarity with the U.S. hostages held in Iran from 1979 to 1981, and seemed to indicate that America was once again the wronged party or victim. In my town, the Boy Scouts affixed yellow ribbons to every tree and bush lining the main street, and similar outbreaks of nationalistic fetishism occurred all over the country. Sports teams and public employees insisted on the right to wear American flag patches on their uniforms. Dissenters, and those deemed to look like Iraqis, were in some cases attacked or threatened with attack. In effect, the war had reduced a nation of millions to the kind of emotional consensus more appropriate to a primordial band of 30 or 40 individuals. In their imaginations, Americans were being threatened by an outsized, barely human enemy, always represented by the lone figure of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. And like the primordial band confronted with a predator, we leaped into a frenzy of defensive action, brandishing the fetishes of our faith, our flags and yellow ribbons, against the intruding beast. A number of scholars have proposed, in the words of social scientist Paul Stern, that nationalism gets its force by drawing on a primordial sociality, rooted in our long prehistory as members of small-scale bands. Mechanisms of entrainment, mass rallies in the case of Nazism, synchronized rituals in the case of state Shinto, televised war news in the contemporary United States, recreate for us the sense of being part of a unified and familiar group, analogous to the primordial band. It may be, as Toynbee suggested, that capitalism, with its war of each against all, leads individuals to crave this experience of unity all the more. To the alienated economic actor, militant nationalism, with its parades and rituals, exhortations and flag-waving, holds out the tantalizing promise of a long-lost Gemeinschaft restored. But socialism, in the 20th century, has hardly been an effective antidote to the twin forces of capitalism and nationalism. It too promised community and self-loss in a collective undertaking. But the project of socialist construction turned out never to be quite so compelling as the project of war. People who would lay down their lives for their country will not necessarily give up a weekend to participate in a harvest or the construction of a dam. Love of our neighbors may stir us, but the threat posed by a common enemy stirs us even more. The sociality of the primordial band is most likely rooted, after all, in the exigencies of defense against animal predators. We may enjoy the company of our fellows, but we thrill to the prospect of joining them in collective defense against the common enemy. Ultimately, 20th century socialism lost out to nationalism for the same reason the universalistic post-axial religions did. It has no blood right at its core, no thrilling spectacle of human sacrifice. 14. The further evolution of war in the 20th century. War is like love. It always finds a way. Bertolt Brecht. In the spring of 1990, 2 months before the beginning of Operation Desert Storm, I gave a presentation on war and warrior elites to a small group of sociologists. They were interested and supportive, but a bit pitying about my choice of a topic. War, they were eager to remind me, had run its course. The Cold War had ended. Communism was over. There were no longer any sides to take. Too bad I had elected to work on a subject of only historical interest. The conviction that war is passé, or soon to become so, has a venerable history of its own. The introduction of the gun, and after that, artillery, seemed to promise levels of destruction so costly that no state would want to risk them. After the gruesome bloodletting of the Napoleonic Wars, philosophers Auguste Comte and John Stuart Mill prophesied that war would end as civilization turned, in relief, to the peaceful business of industrial production. World War I was, of course, the war to end all wars. A quarter century later, the nuclear weapons developed and used in World War II seemed to doom war once and for all. Ghoulish wonks might play with scenarios for limited nuclear war and flexible responses. But anyone with sense could see that war has been vanquished, as Robert L. O'Connell has put it, defeated by its own weaponry. In the last few years, obituaries for war, or at least predictions of its imminent demise, have been coming thick and fast. In his 1989 book, Retreat from Doomsday, John Muller argued that major war, war among developed countries, has gradually moved toward terminal disrepute because of its perceived repulsiveness and futility. John Keegan, in his History of Warfare, expressed the hope that, at last, after 5,000 years of recorded war-making, cultural and material changes may be working to inhibit man's proclivity to take up arms. And in his most recent book, Ride of the Second Horseman, O'Connell finds the grim horseman thrown from his mount. Thanks to the growth of international trade and the emergence of international economic institutions, war has ceased to be functional. But no matter how futile, repulsive, or dysfunctional war may be, it persists. There have been 160 wars of various sizes since World War II, and by 1994, these had taken the lives of an estimated 22 million people. Many of these wars have been conventional, in the sense of pitting one good-sized nation-state against another, Iran against Iraq, for example, or Iraq against the United States and its allies. Many others have been decidedly unconventional, featuring belligerents which are not nation-states, but ethnic groups, factions, and religious movements. As Martin von Krefeld argues, what we have been witnessing is not the death or atrophy of war, but its transformation. The nature of the entities by which war is made, the conventions by which it is surrounded, and the ends for which it is fought may change. However, now as ever, war itself is alive and well. In a sense, war has found a way around the obstacles placed in its way by the scholars of militarism. Since armed conflict between the major nation-states is too costly and too likely to tip over into nuclear holocaust, war has taken other forms. Now it is likely to be low intensity, or as German essayist Hans Magnus Enzensberger terms it, molecular, with the diminutives referring to the size of the warring units, rather than to the cost in human life. The new kind of war is less disciplined and more spontaneous than the old, often fought by ill-clad bands more resembling gangs than armies. But it is, from a civilian point of view, more lethal than ever. Recall that in World War I, 15% of the fatalities were civilians, with that proportion rising to 65% in World War II. In the low-intensity wars of the late 20th century, the wars of Ivory Coast, Somalia, Sudan, Liberia, East Timor, and the former Yugoslavia, civilians constitute 90% of the dead. Whatever the psychology of this new type of war, and there has been much vaporizing about a recrudescence of evil in the world, one particular innovation has made it possible, and that is the emergence of an international market in small arms. The modern nation-state came into being, as we have seen earlier, as a support system for the mass army. Today, however, anyone can purchase guns, and almost anything else they might need, vehicles, canteens, boots, camouflage clothes, on the open market. Even military training and leadership is available, for a price, from mercenary groups and U.S. firms employing retired officers. Somalia, for example, had no arms industry and very little infrastructure of any kind during the years it was being torn in shreds by warring factions. The guns were provided by the superpowers of the Northern Hemisphere. With a thriving black market in weapons recycled by the former guerrillas of Mozambique, Nicaragua, and Afghanistan, the nation-state is no longer necessary as the unit of militarism. A warlord with cash and a coterie of followers will do. And it is not only the expertise and hardware of war that is available in the international marketplace. The very spirit of war, the glory and romance once associated with particular noble lineages and later nations, has become a commodity available in the global consumer culture. With Rambo and his ilk, Hollywood offers up a denationalized generic warrior hero, a man of few words and limited loyalties, suitable for universal emulation. An American journalist described Russian Special Forces fighters in Chechnya this way. The soldiers were dressed in preposterous Rambo outfits, headbands, mirrored shades, sleeveless muscle shirts, bandoliers, belt packed with hunting knives. They wanted nothing more than to look like their movie hero. They had seen all his movies on video, and how they melted at the sound of his name. "You know Sly?" they asked. "You really know Sly?" It is in the post-national factions of today's molecular wars that these images are probably most effective, complementing and even substituting for makeshift notions of tribal and ethnic identity. Serbian soldiers also affect Rambo-style headbands and bandoliers. A Liberian guerrilla fighter takes General Rambo as his nom de guerre. Within the United States, the Rambo culture helps inspire a grassroots militia movement dedicated to preserving and expanding the individual's right to bear arms, including assault weapons normally reserved for the police and the military. So the democratization of glory, begun in the mass armies of the 18th and 19th centuries, may eventually outlive the mass army, with its oppressive discipline and its constitutionally ordained subordination to civilian government. Every man a warrior hero seems to be the great populist demand of the late 20th century. And if every man is to have his experience of warrior glory, every man must have his war. The right-wing rural American stockpiles weapons in preparation for eventual battle with immigrants, African Americans, or government forces, while his suburban counterpart pays to spend weekends in mock wars, fought with paintballs instead of bullets. Degendering war. One feature of the transformed war of the nuclear age is that it is less likely to be the exclusive province of males or even of adults. This degendering of war reflects, above all, the continuing revolution wrought by guns. There has never been a weapon that some women could not wield, but the gun, easy to carry and dependent for its lethal force on chemical rather than muscular energy, is potentially within reach of all. The democratizing trend it set in motion, which began in the 16th century with the elevation of the foot soldier's role, extends now increasingly to the human categories traditionally excluded from combat: women, and even children. Nationalism has been another force militating toward the greater inclusion of women. Unlike the elite warrior ethos of another era, nationalism does not discriminate on the basis of gender or class. Women, as well as men, are expected to participate in the worship of their nation's flags and other sacred symbols, to cheer at parades and rallies, to sacrifice for the war effort. World War I, as we saw at the beginning of this book, inspired the same transports of enthusiasm among women as it did among men. In wartime England, for example, suffrage leaders abandoned their cause for war-related efforts, such as attempts to publicly shame men they judged to be shirkers. In the United States, the changes occurred more rapidly than anyone could have imagined just a couple of decades ago. At that time, the prospect of women dying in combat was sufficiently alarming that it helped mobilize votes against the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution. But a few years later, the deaths of 11 women and the capture of two in the U.S.-led Gulf War aroused no special indignation. The idea of a weaker sex requiring male protection had lost its grip. Though still largely barred from direct combat, women now serve in a variety of new roles: directing artillery, piloting helicopters, operating supply depots. Meanwhile, a few bold and sturdy women have gained admission to the service academies where the officer elite is trained, have become fighter pilots, and have even found berths on combat vessels. We no longer hail our boys as they go forth to war, but our men and women. And in some settings, children. The warring factions in Liberia routinely recruited young boys as men at arms. During the war between Iran and Iraq, both nations fielded troops consisting of boys in their teens or younger. There is nothing about the gun, after all, which says it cannot be wielded by a child. But when little boys, and occasionally also girls, can be enlisted, then clearly war can no longer serve its ancient function as a male ritual of initiation. if gender remains a meaningful category at all. In Liberia, fighters in one armed faction carried out some of their massacres while dressed, bizarrely, in blonde wigs and tutus. The degendering of war does not mean that masculinity will cease to be a desirable attribute, only that it will be an attribute that women, as well as men, can possess. Already in popular usage, the dismissive term wimp is applied almost as readily to women as to men, implying that the appropriate stance for both sexes is tough and potentially battle-ready. The division of humanity into masculine and feminine may persist, but these categories may have less and less to do with the biological sexes. This is not an entirely negative development from a woman's perspective. With the admission of women to warrior status, we may be ready for the long overdue recognition that it was not only human males who made the transition from prey to predator, but the entire human race. How far the degendering of war will go is still very much an open question. Von Krefeld, for one, sees the transformation of war inevitably stopping short of the continued incorporation of women, if only because of entrenched and irrational male resistance. Indeed, at every step toward their incorporation into the military, women have been met with coarse, misogynist resistance, jeers, hazings, and above all, sexual assaults and harassment, aimed at reminding them that, in the most primitive calculus, women are still not predators, but prey. There is no reason to think that men, as a sex, will give up their starring role in war any more easily than mounted knights once gave up theirs. But the inclusion of women has gone far enough to cast serious doubts on any theory of war that derives exclusively from considerations of gender. War has been seen by many cultures as a male initiation rite and a defining male activity. But it need not remain so. When war ceases to serve one function, for example, the capture of prisoners for human sacrifice or the seizure of land for agricultural expansion, it generally finds another. So war has come to depend less on the human social institutions that have sustained it for centuries, if not millennia. One of these is male supremacy, as embodied in the all-male warrior elite. Another is that superb social instrument of war, the nation-state, in whose name all major wars have been fought for more than 200 years. To anyone who had believed that war could be abolished by severing its links to male privilege, or by healing the artificial division of our species into nations, the end of the 20th century can only bring gloom. War has little loyalty to even the most warlike of human institutions, and may, ominously enough, have little use for humans themselves. 20th century military technologists have already begun preparations for a version of war in which autonomous weapons will be given the responsibility for killing human beings without human direction or supervision. The Beast in Modern Form. Looking back on the developments of the 20th century and on the four centuries of gun-based warfare that preceded it, one is tempted to reformulate the ancient puzzle of what it is that gives war its iron grip on human cultures. Traditionally, the puzzle has been posed as a question about human nature. What is it in us that draws us over and over to an undertaking we know to be destructive and suspect, in most cases, to be thoroughly immoral? But when we reflect on war's remarkable resilience in the face of changing circumstances, we cannot help wanting to turn the question around for a moment to ask instead, what is this thing that humans have been so fatally drawn to? If war is not firmly rooted in some human subgroup, adult males, for example, or any other relative elite, if it is not the product of some particular form of human social organization, feudalism, the nation-state, or capitalism, then what exactly is it? This is not, I should remind the reader, the question I set out to answer in this book. The aim of the book was not to explain the existence of war, but more modestly, to understand the uniquely religious feelings humans bring to it. These feelings are not indissolubly wedded to the project of war. As William James wisely observed, the kind of courage and altruism people bring to war could conceivably be redirected to some more worthy enterprise or moral equivalent of war. Nor is war dependent, for its existence, on the special feelings we attach to it. War can be waged, and often has been, without any great and noble sentiments. It is routinely waged, in fact, by ants. In trying to understand what war is, we have been misled, I would argue, by the apparent linkage between war and various other institutions, hierarchies of class, gender, and political leadership, for example. Analyze any war-making society, and sure enough, you will find the practice of war apparently embedded in and dependent upon that society's economy, culture, system of gender relations, and so forth. But change that economy and culture, as in going from a hunting-gathering to an agricultural way of life, or from agriculture to industry, and war will, most likely, be found to persist. So it is the autonomy of war as an institution that we have to confront and explain. Is war something which really does have a life of its own? As we observed in Chapter 9, war can be analogized, in a mathematical sense, to a process caused by living things, in particular, to a disease brought about by microorganisms. War is contagious, as we have noted, spreading readily from one culture to the next. And once the famous cycle of violence has begun, there is, of course, no stopping it. Each injury demands the counter-injury known as revenge. Thus, war is, in some not yet entirely defined sense, a self-replicating pattern of behavior, possessed of a dynamism not unlike that of living things. Social science provides us with no category for such an entity, but other fields are beginning to offer what look, at least for now, like promising frameworks. One of these is the biologist Richard Dawkins's concept of a meme. Searching for a way to describe cultural evolution, he proposed the concept of self-replicating units of culture, analogous to genes. Like genes, these memes seek to copy themselves as widely as possible, and also like genes, are subject to certain, so far unexamined, selective forces. The underlying idea, which gains a certain respectability from the new dual inheritance model of evolution, is that culture, like biology, may be subject to evolutionary laws of its own, with the fittest memes winning out, in time, over the other cultural possibilities. Unfortunately, it is not too easy to say what the evolutionarily significant units of culture may be. Sometimes Dawkins and his followers, in what is optimistically called the science of memetics, refer to the slenderest bits of cultural ephemera, tunes, phrases, images, as memes. But while tunes or phrases can be infectious in their own way, their reproduction, on compact discs or printed pages, seems largely a matter of human whim. At other times, Dawkins includes rather grander notions, such as the idea of a deity, as memes, though clearly the idea of a deity exists at a vastly higher level of complexity than, say, a particular image of a deity. The image, a particular painting of Jesus, for example, will be more or less the same for all who behold it, and can be described, more or less adequately, by a simple code suitable for electronic transmission. Not so, however, with the idea of God. Not only does the idea vary from person to person, and within each person depending on mood and the vicissitudes of faith, but it often contains within it a complex set of behavioral instructions. Love thy neighbor, light candles on Shabbos, avoid pork and alcohol, or whatever. If war can be thought of as a meme, clearly it is a meme like religion, rather than like for example, a popular tune. It cannot be reduced, as a tune can, to any simple sequence of symbols. Rather, it would have to be conceived as a loose assemblage of algorithms or programs, in the computer sense, for action. When living in the vicinity of a tribe that possesses large numbers of spears, it is wise to make spears of one's own. When approached by a group of men brandishing spears, it is a good idea to muster up a spear-bearing group of one's own. When attacked, fight back, or run very fast, and so forth. Considered as a self-reproducing cultural entity or meme, war appears to be far more robust than any particular religion, perhaps more robust than religion in general. Compare, for example, the reproductive efficacy of war to that of a superficially rather similar religious practice, human sacrifice. Both involve killing people, and both tend to invoke rather exalted explanations for why the killing must be done. But human sacrifice can spread only by imitation. War, on the other hand, requires far less by way of human acquiescence. You may admire the religious fervor that leads the neighboring tribe to immolate its children, but you are not required to follow suit. In the case of war, there is very little choice. If the neighboring band decides to capture and immolate your children or steal your herds and grain stores, your group can fight back or prepare to face extinction. Given its tenacity and near universality, war is surely one of the fittest of memes. Memetics remains in its infancy. But for our purposes, the truly sobering aspect of Dawkins's idea is that fitness for a meme may have little or nothing to do with the biological fitness or well-being of the people who act in conformity with it. If culture is governed by laws analogous to those of natural selection, these laws are not selecting for stronger or happier people, but for more successful memes. What we have not previously considered, Dawkins writes, apparently referring to a century of social science, is that a cultural trait may have evolved in the way that it has simply because it is advantageous to itself. Thus, if war is understood as a self-replicating entity, we should probably abandon the many attempts to explain it as an evolutionary adaptation, which has been, in some ecological sense, useful or helpful to humans. Biology instructs us to raise large numbers of healthy children, the clearest possible measure of biological fitness. But culture can countermand this instruction with the idea that it is glorious to die young in war. Culture, in other words, cannot be counted on to be on our side. Insofar as it allows humans to escape the imperatives of biology, it may do so only to entrap us in what are often crueler imperatives of its own. Another possible way of thinking about war as a self-replicating activity comes from computer science, though not from the part that seeks to provide models for the human mind. Perhaps, surprisingly, this infant science has come up with a new notion of life, and one that goes well beyond the water and carbon-based chemical engines that we usually recognize as animals, plants, and microorganisms. Computer scientists are generating new life forms that have no material substance at all. They are programs, computer viruses would be the most familiar example, that have been designed to reproduce themselves and, in some cases, even to undergo spontaneous mutations. Such creatures, which can be represented on a computer screen as dots or fish or lions or anything else one fancies, can be programmed to evolve in response to selective forces imposed by the experimenter. If two or more species of them are present, they may quite spontaneously enter into such lifelike relationships as those of symbiosis and parasitism. These self-reproducing computer programs demand a definition of living being as a pattern in space, time, rather than a specific material object. Such a being must be able not only to reproduce itself, but to undergo mutations, and hence to evolve, over the course of generations. If technological changes in weaponry, transportation, and so on are understood as the relevant mutations, then war, in some rough sense, may fit this kind of expanded definition. With the introduction of the horse as part of the technology of war some 4,000 years ago, war mutated into an occupation for mounted elites. With the introduction of the gun, it mutated again, this time into an activity potentially accessible to the common man and woman. And following each such mutation in the mechanism of war, human social institutions, with their ancient hierarchies of class and gender, can only scramble to keep up. But whether we base our analogies on genes or computer programs, we are looking for a way to understand how human societies may, in a sense, fall prey to living entities that were originally of our own creation. This tragic possibility is implicit, it seems to me, in Marx's description of capitalism. In Capital, as in that other 19th century classic, Frankenstein, human creativity brings forth something, market system or monster, which humans can no longer control. Humans invented market systems and bring strong feelings to them, greed, most notably, but also the desire for adventure and sometimes even altruistic concerns for the general welfare. But once underway, market systems, and perhaps especially those of the industrial capitalist variety, have a dynamism of their own, which no socialist enclave has yet found a way to resist for any length of time. The market comes to act like a force of nature, dictating, or at least severely circumscribing, the choices of anyone who hopes to remain a player. This outcome would seem to fit Andrew Bard Schmuckler's observation that, with the rise of civilization, human creativity ceased to drive the mill of cultural evolution, but rather became its grist. War is not the only self-replicating social institution. The familiar hierarchies of race, gender, and class are also endowed with a certain ability to reproduce themselves. Insofar as the members of a supposedly inferior group are denied adequate nutrition or education or access to important resources, they will indeed remain inferior. Girls who are barred from education on the basis of their sex's presumed intellectual deficits may well end up as examples of why women can't be educated, and will often pass this implicit judgment on to their own daughters. Black children who are underfed and consigned to underfunded schools will, very often, be handicapped for life. This does not mean that social hierarchies cannot be overthrown, only that those who would overthrow them should be aware of their almost lifelike power to persist. As reformers have had to learn again and again, simply declaring a group equal does not end the dreary dynamic that has condemned it to inequality thus far. Someday, perhaps, social theory will be in a position to understand human culture as a medium, a primeval soup, as it were, within which abstract entities like war, and possibly also capitalism, religion, and science, not only live and reproduce, but also interact. For now, let us content ourselves with observing that they do indeed interact, and in complex, evolving ways. War, for example, has for millennia existed in a symbiotic relationship with male domination, both drawing strength from and giving nourishment to it. But this mutual dependence only goes so far. There have been cultures, like that of the Inuit, which are both peaceable and male-dominated, just as there is now a culture, that of the United States, which is both militaristic and, at least officially, egalitarian with respect to gender. War has thrived through its symbiosis with male domination, but it can also do quite nicely on its own. Market systems have an even more complex history of interaction with the self-replicating pattern that is war. During the feudal era, for example, the European warrior elite disdained the nascent market and the men who made it work. But as William H. McNeill argues in The Pursuit of Power, it was the eventual synergy of markets and militarism that helped pave the way for the burst of European imperial expansionism from the 16th century on. Something like that synergy persists in the United States, where the market economy has become thoroughly addicted to the manufacture of weapons and the government expenditures that underwrite it. But on a global scale, the interaction between war and the market system, or, if you will, the memes for war and markets, has grown more complex and sometimes hostile. The now global marketplace tends to homogenize cultures and produce a single community of, say, Coca-Cola drinkers or Marlboro smokers. At the same time, the far older war system exerts a centripetal force, fractioning the human population into warring subgroups. I should emphasize that the notion of a cultural entity as a quasi-living being does not impute to that entity any intentions or objectives of its own. In fact, I was being overly colorful at the beginning of this discussion in saying that such entities seek to reproduce. They seek nothing. As with strands of viral DNA, it is just that those that have managed to reproduce successfully are still around. For anything like intentionality or passion or ambition or hope, these self-replicating cultural entities are dependent entirely on us. And in this sense, we have more than served their purpose. This book has been about the passions of war, and they are, as we have seen, among the highest and finest passions humans can know: courage, altruism, and the mystical sense of belonging to something larger than ourselves. But if we concede to war at least some measure of the autonomy enjoyed by living things, then we must acknowledge that we have invested these lofty passions in a peculiar kind of god indeed, an entity that is ultimately alien to us and supremely indifferent to our fate. We have sacrificed our loved ones for what is worse than nothing. We have sacrificed them for something that has no use for us. To return to the question I posed at the beginning of this section: what is war that it exerts such cruel demands on us? It is first, in an economic sense, a parasite on human cultures, draining them of the funds and resources, talent and personnel, that could be used to advance the cause of human life and culture. But parasitism is too mild a term for a relationship predicated on the periodic killing of large numbers of human beings. If war is a living thing, it is a kind of creature that, by its very nature, devours us. To look at war carefully and long enough is to see the face of the predator over which we thought we had triumphed long ago. Fighting war. War, at the end of the 20th century, is a more formidable adversary than it has ever been. It can no longer be localized within a particular elite, and hence overthrown in a brilliant act of revolution. Revolution, in fact, was redefined by Lenin and others as little more than a species of war, fought by disciplined cadres, organized along the same hierarchical lines as the mass armies of the modern era. Meanwhile, war has dug itself into economic systems, where it offers a livelihood to millions, rather than to just a handful of craftsmen and professional soldiers. It has lodged in our souls as a kind of religion, a quick tonic for political malaise, and a bracing antidote to the moral torpor of consumerist, market-driven cultures. In addition, our incestuous fixation on combat with our own kind has left us ill-prepared to face many of the larger perils of the situation in which we find ourselves: the possibility of drastic climatic changes, the depletion of natural resources, the relentless predations of the microbial world. The wealth that flows ceaselessly to the project of war is wealth lost, for the most part, to the battle against these threats. In the United States, military spending no longer requires a credible enemy to justify it, while funding for sanitation, nutrition, medical care, and environmental reclamation declines even as the need mounts. In the Third World, and much of the post-communist world, the preparedness for war far surpasses the readiness to combat disease. Witness Zaire's fumbling efforts to contain the Ebola outbreak of 1995, or the swiftly declining life expectancy of the former Soviets. But in at least one way, we have gotten tougher and better prepared to face the enemy that is war. If the 20th century brought the steady advance of war and war-related enterprises, it also brought the beginnings of organized human resistance to war. Anti-war movements, arising in massive force in the latter half of the century, are themselves products of the logic of modern war, with its requirements of mass participation and dissent. When the practice and passions of war were largely confined to a warrior elite, popular opposition to war usually took the form of opposition to that elite. But in the situation where everyone is expected to participate in one way or another, and where anyone can become a victim, whether they participate or not, opposition could at last develop to the institution of war itself. This represents an enormous human achievement. Any anti-war movement that targets only the human agents of war, a warrior elite, or in our own time, the chieftains of the military-industrial complex, risks mimicking those it seeks to overcome. Anti-war activists can become macho and belligerent warriors in their own right, just as revolutionaries all too often evolve into fatigue-clad replacements for the oppressors they overthrow. So it is a giant step from hating the warriors to hating the war, and an even greater step to deciding that the enemy is the abstract institution of war, which maintains its grip on us even in the interludes we know as peace. The anti-war movements of the late 20th century are admittedly feeble undertakings compared to that which they oppose. They are reactive and ad hoc, emerging, usually tardily, in response to particular wars, then ebbing to nothing in times of peace. They are fuzzy-minded, moralistic, and often committed to cartoonish theories of the sources of war, that it is a product of capitalism, for example, or testosterone or some similar flaw. But for all their failings, anti-war movements should already have taught us one crucial lesson, that the passions we bring to war can be brought just as well to the struggle against war. There is a place for courage and solidarity and self-sacrifice other than in the service of this peculiarly bloody institution, this inhuman meme, a place for them in the struggle to shake ourselves free of it. I myself would be unable to imagine the passions of war if I had not, at various times in my life, linked arms with the men and women around me and marched up, singing or chanting, to the waiting line of armed and uniformed men. And we will need all the courage we can muster. What we are called to is, in fact, a kind of war. We will need armies, or at least networks of committed activists willing to act in concert when necessary, to oppose force with numbers, and passion with forbearance and reason. We will need leaders, not a handful of generals, but huge numbers of individuals able to take the initiative to educate, inspire, and rally others. We will need strategies and cunning, ways of assessing the enemy's strength and sketching out the way ahead. And even with all that, the struggle will be enormously costly. Those who fight war on this war-ridden planet must prepare themselves to lose battle after battle and still fight on, to lose security, comfort, position, even life. But what have all the millennia of warfare prepared us for, if not this Armageddon, fought once more against a predator beast? This has been a Hachette audio production of Blood Rites, written by Barbara Ehrenreich. Read by Amy Landon. Produced by Robert Van Kolken. Post-production by Featured Audio. Blood Rites is also available in print and digital formats from 12, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hacheteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1997 by Barbara Ehrenreich. Introduction copyright 2020 by Mark Danner. Audio production copyright 2020, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.